Welcome to the candidates tonight, our board members. Sponsored by the Coalition for the Right to Vote on Desalination. Tonight is really a chance for dialogue. I've been involved with this issue for over a couple of years and been trying to be in dialogue with the City Council, with the Water Department, and not always successfully. So tonight I want there to be an opportunity for dialogue. This is not just about finding out where the candidates stand on issues, although that's part of it. It's also an opportunity for us to engage. We anticipate that the voters will be able to decide this question of desalination. That the City Council already expressed their intention, and Measure P would put that into the charter, the right of the people to vote on desalination. So we do anticipate that the decision will ultimately be in the hands of the voters. And what that means is we have a period of time now in which the city leaders and citizens in the community can engage in some dialogue. And I think if it didn't start tonight, it certainly can continue tonight. So it's in that spirit of dialogue that I invite you to participate. We're going to have, I'm going to give a presentation, first of all, because I want to just bring everybody up to speed, including the candidates, about kind of the history of this issue and what the alternatives to desalination are. Then there'll be questions posed by a member of Engineers for Water Alternatives, a member of a group called Peak Water, and then a member of a group on campus called Teach the Forest. And then I will pose some other questions to the candidates, and after that, you'll get your chance to stand up and ask a question. And we'll be out of here by 8:30. So I want to welcome the candidates. First of all, thank you all for coming. For just being willing to serve on the City Council, and for those of you who've already been on the City Council, thank you for your service. It's really it's not a well-paid plum of a position, and it's a matter of community service. So I think we all need to give them a hand for being willing to do that. So I want to start tonight by, and you all can turn your chairs around if you want to see the slideshow. I want to start tonight just briefly, ever so briefly, talking about why should we even consider alternatives to desalination? I mean, what's the problem with desalination after all? It's really comes down to the financial cost and the environmental cost of desalination. You see in this slide, in 2003, when the City Council was presented with the idea of desalination, the total cost for building the plant was given to them as $32 million, and it's gone up since then, quadrupled since then. So the figure that we have now, which is not really a complete figure, it's a figure from the Urban Water Management Plan last year, $116 million from 2010 on. So that doesn't really include all the costs that were incurred for the pilot desalination plant that was built before 2010. Here's another way to look at costs of desalinated water. The only number that we have for cost per unit of water is in this integrated water plan 2003, $170 for 1 million gallons to transmit and treat Loch Wellman water. Now the numbers we have for desalination, the first number, 19,000 for 1 million gallons, is from the California Public Utilities Commission Division of Ratepayer Advocates when they were estimating on the Monterey plant, proposed Monterey plant. There's also a number that Soquel Creek Water District had their consultant do. That number, 19,000, is not cost of desal per 1 million gallons, but the cost of their whole water system, per 1 million gallons, including desal, after desal would be built. We have some history around the country of desalination. This is the only major desalination plant in the United States in Tampa Bay, Florida, and there were problems with it, and it's still not supplying the amount of water that was promised. In Australia, they've had similar problems with this technology. So just very briefly, the environmental costs of desalination, there are energy impacts and there are marine impacts. The marine impacts are basically you're cleansing 7 million gallons a day of ocean water, of any kind of marine life that's in it. So anything smaller than 2 millimeters that runs through the grate and into the plant will be killed. And that includes plankton, it includes krill, it includes fish larvae. Now, they've already done the piece of the environmental impact report on the impact of the ocean intake, and they consider it not significant. And that's really, you know, when you're comparing that to Moss Landing, which sucks in hundreds of millions of gallons a day, it is a lot smaller than that. And yet, we wonder if, even though it's small, 7 million gallons, if this is the right direction that we want to take. The energy impact is what got me involved as a former electrical contractor. I was thinking that the energy intensity of desalination is something that really ought to make us pause, especially nowadays. You know, when you consider the trouble that we have to go to get fossil fuel energy. I mean, basically, if you like fracking, you know, then you're okay with desal. But if you don't like fracking and all the other kinds of ways that we have to get our energy supplies, you want to go in the other direction. So let's talk about the alternatives. The city wants to, by building a desalination plant, the city wants to secure the citizens in case of a drought. So this is from the website. If a critical drought similar to 1976-77 occurred today, shortages would be in excess of 40%. So they have done they've charted the runoff in the river over a 90-year period, and 1977 was the worst year in that period, and so that's the drought of record with which we're getting this figure of over 40% curtailment during if that were to repeat itself. 1975, when we look at what happened before that critical drought, there was a two-year drought, 76, the winter of 76, and the winter of 77, when it hardly rained. 75 was a record water consumption for the city up to that point. And as a result, the Loch Lomond Reservoir at the end of the dry season was down to 60% capacity. And evidently, that wasn't really enough to supply the city's needs in the next 2 years. Currently, this estimate of over 40% shortfall, it comes from an assumption. It comes from the assumption that we run the lake down to 64% capacity, even in normal years. As a matter of fact, the water department is not doing that. We're not running the lake down. We're not taking the whole complement of water rights that we're allowed to by the state, which is 1 billion gallons a year at Loch Lomond. We're taking less than half of that right now. So what that means is that the lake is much higher. And that would make sense, right? Isn't that the goal? To keep more water in the lake in case of a drought, right? So just for example, if we kept 80% water in the capacity at the end of the dry season, which is October 1st of each year, the difference between that low level, 64%, and 80% is 450 million gallons. And that's comparable to the desal output. So you can consider that one desal plant right there if somehow we were able to keep the lake at 80%. Well, in fact, we've kept the lake above 80% for the last several years. And we're doing it right now. I checked in the newspaper. You can look at the lake level in the weather section. It says Loch Lomond capacity, and it's 92.5% right now. So what that means is we're in an excellent situation if next year were a really dry winter. If this winter were a really dry winter, we're in an excellent situation. We're much better off than that 64% capacity. We're much better off than if we were at 64% and we had a desal plant. So, how do we safeguard the level of water in the lake?
Well, first of all, there are some threats to the drought reserves that we have in Loch Lomond. And growth in water demand, of course, as the city grows, and there'll be more strains on our water supply. And there's also reductions in stream diversion due to fish habitat constraints. Let me talk about what that is. So the picture you see is of San Lorenzo River at the time when it was actually a fishing destination. There were people that filled the hotels in Santa Cruz to come fishing. And of course, that doesn't happen anymore. Coho salmon really haven't appeared in the river for close to 30 years. And the steelhead populations have gone way down. As a result, the federal government has gotten involved. And the federal government agency charged with enforcing the Endangered Species Act is called the National Marine Fisheries Service. In 2002, the National Marine Fisheries Service put their legal action on hold. They put it in abeyance, according to their representative, John Ambrose, who came to the city council last year. He said, we were going to do a legal action against the city, and we put it on hold while the city did a habitat conservation plan in which they were going to describe how they were going to meet the habitat needs of the fish through allowing more water to flow in the streams. So sometimes you hear that the habitat conservation plan is a voluntary process. The city water department will say, well, we're doing this voluntarily. Well, that's really a half-truth. It's voluntary, but they were doing it as a result of a legal action that was put on hold. So let's talk about growth for a second. So three out of the four water sources are tapped out. The fourth, Loch Lomond, still has the capacity to satisfy growth. Of course, that's our only drought reserve. And this statement is from the a really revealing document that the Water Department put out in 2004. It says, any future increase in seasonal or annual demand for water will be felt through greater and greater withdrawals from Loch Lomond Reservoir. Continuing to provide water to new customers upon request, as is the current practice, may do harm to existing customers by making the potential water shortage situation worse than it otherwise would be. Up to now, the point at which this responsibility to protect the public health and safety of existing customers from drought impacts outweighs the other duty to serve new customers has never been defined. Well, it actually has been defined de facto just in the last few years, and we'll talk about that. The next sentence kind of gives you an indication of how it's been resolved. It might be all right to accept a higher level of drought risk if the desalination project remains pretty much on schedule and if the outlook for success remains optimistic. So in other words, the choice has been made. For example, in the city's general plan, the choice has been made to allow water demand to rise, and the effect on existing customers is acknowledged in this very candid report. However, the solution has been desalination. And if we weren't going to go to desal, then we'd need to find another way to deal with growth, right? This is the general plan that was just adopted in June. It had a report that went along with it, a water supply assessment, which projected there would be up to a 15% increase in our water demand by 2030. I want to call your attention to the contrast with our neighboring district, Soquel Creek Water District, which projects a 7.5% decrease in their water demand by the same year, 2030. So you're probably asking, well, why? What's the difference? Well, Soquel Creek has a water neutral development policy. And the way they operate is if there's a developer that wants to build a building, that developer pays into a fund to offset the new demand that's created by that new development. Santa Cruz does not have that. Santa Cruz has a conservation program that's paid for overwhelmingly by ratepayers, water customers, and we can talk about that, but the new development pays into a system development charge, it's so-called, but a very small fraction of the system development charge goes to conservation. So about 30% of the growth in Santa Cruz demand is from UCSC expansion. Here's a chart of the campus water consumption in the past several years, and then that bar on the right is their projected consumption in 2020. So You can see it more than doubles from last year's consumption. So that's an issue for us. Now, there's an agency that is in charge of deciding whether or not the city gets to extend water service to the university, and that's called LAFCO. LAFCO is the Local Agency Formation Commission. And a couple years ago, they set a policy, and their policy is, in any proposal requiring water service, the commission requires that the agency that will provide the water will need to demonstrate the availability of an adequate, reliable, and sustainable supply of water. So the big question for LAFCO is the city of Santa Cruz water supply adequate? Well, we have some answers from some expert sources. One is the Environmental Impact Report on the UC Water Service Extension, and that said there are inadequate water supplies to serve the project under existing and future multiple dry year conditions. We also have the National Marine Fisheries Service writing a letter to LAFCO saying it does not appear that current water supplies are sufficient to meet current demand and protect listed salmonids, let alone allow for increased demands resulting from expansion of the city's service area. So this is, I've tried to depict the fact that there is competition over a limited amount of water in Loch Lomond. We have the existing customers who, most of us here, would like to keep water in the lake in case of drought, right? There are the fish needs, and those demands to leave more water in the streams for fish will mean that there's going to be more water taken out of Loch Lomond so that more water can be left in the streams for fish. And then there's also UCSC expansion, which is going to place demands on that water in the lake. Now, for those of you who may have been following this subject, there's been the argument put forward that, well, no, the UCSC will not actually take water out of the lake. It will not reduce our drought security because of a water neutrality plan. And I, for one, have been pushing for a water neutrality for the entire city service area for over 2 years, and so I'm welcoming the idea of water neutrality with this one condition. Water neutrality means that you're going to use, like Soquel Creek does, you're going to use conservation offsets to offset growth in demand. Now, the only problem with that right now is that the fisheries agencies are leaning heavily on us to reduce our water demand, to reduce our water diversion from the streams. We may need every conservation measure we can find in order to reduce our water demand to supply those needs of the fish. Otherwise, if it's taken out of the lake, you know what happens. We're all going to be more at risk for drought. So this is really accurate to say that the university and the fish are in competition for those same conservation measures. In the case of the university, the proposal is that the university pay for rebates on very efficient washing machines. And there's a considerable amount of potential if people change out their washing machines from an old washing machine. Well, we may need that strategy, but the thing is, we don't know if we need it or not, because the city and the fisheries agencies have not come to a resolution about how much water is required for the fish in the streams. So LAFCO did what I think was a very sensible thing, or actually there is a proposal that I think is very sensible, and that is this proposed by John Leopold. The city shall not commence delivery of water to the UCSC campus until the city has entered into a binding habitat conservation plan agreement with the National Marine Fisheries Service. So, are you following me? If LAFCO puts this condition into effect, then we get to see how much water we really have in our water supply before we decide to extend more water to the university. And that seems to be an utterly reasonable condition. And I have to say that I'm disappointed that our representatives from Santa Cruz on LAFCO, which is Don Lane, our mayor, and Neil Coonerty, our supervisor, have voted against this when it came up in March. And so we're hoping that we can persuade Don and Neil to actually choose drought security for existing residents before the university expansion, and I'm hopeful that, that we all can persuade them to do that. There's a LAFCO meeting either November 7th or December 5th, but if you sign up on our sign-up sheet, we'll tell you which one it is in which they're going to be making that decision. Let me remind you of what happened in 2006. The citizens of Santa Cruz voted by an 80% margin in favor of Measure J, which said that the vote of the people would be required before extending water service to the university. And it, so it passed, but it's not law. And what happened? The UCSC lawyers sued in court to overturn this. They were successful based on technicality. The city did not publish in the newspaper notice of the hearing in the proper timely period. And so the vote of the people was overturned. But nevertheless, I would venture to say that most people would still agree that the people want to figure out whether we have enough water to give, right? The current city administration position on UCSC growth, I'm taking it as the position of the city attorney, which says that he'll sue LAFCO if LAFCO imposes this very reasonable condition of waiting to see how much water we have before offering more water to the university. Now, how do we get from 80% of the people wanting a chance to say about university growth to the city suing if they actually give the people what they want? I don't really get it, and I'm hoping the city council candidates can answer how they stand on that. So I'm almost done, and then we'll hear from the candidates. I do want to talk about, well, we've talked about a water neutral development policy, which I think is really necessary, with the caveat that first we figure out those conservation measures to go for the fish first. And we have to know how much water we were supposed to leave in the streams in order to know that. I want to talk about water transfers with neighboring districts. The concept is that Santa Cruz, which has so much water running down the San Lorenzo River in the wintertime, could share with neighboring districts, Soquel Creek and Scotts Valley, during the wintertime, and in return that water would come back to Santa Cruz because they're on well water, you see. They're not so affected by drought. They could send water back to Santa Cruz in a drought. So what's the potential for this plan? Well, I want to invite you to look at this chart. And that squiggly line you see, is that's 2010. You can kind of ignore that. Look at the brown line. The brown line is the 72-year mean flow. So half the years it's above that, and half the years it's less than that. In the years from, in the months from mid-January to mid-April, it's above 100 cubic feet per second flowing in the river, okay? 100 cubic feet per second is a lot more than we're diverting right now. We're diverting 5.4 cubic feet per second. There's a lot of water in the river that we're not using. The city's water right is 12 cubic feet per second, so without changing any water rights, you know, there's a significant amount of water that could go to neighboring districts. John Ricker from the county, who's really heading up this effort for water transfers, he's proposing that the water rights be revised so that 20 cubic feet per second could be taken out of the river. So five for the city, 5.5 for the city, the rest for neighboring districts. That's a lot of water. Bill Coker, who is our water director, has said that well, with the county's work, we'll almost certainly conclude what the five previous studies on the subject have concluded, that Santa Cruz does not have a reliable water supply of water, and Soquel Creek does not have an adequate supply of water to make a water transfer an alternative that addresses the serious water shortage needs of either agency. Well, that's really not how I read the several engineering studies that have talked about conjunctive use. We had the Kennedy Jenks North County Water Master Plan, which recommended it. There was a Santa Cruz Water Master Plan that recommended conjunctive use with Scotts Valley District. And then finally, Caro Engineers that recommended conjunctive use with Soquel Creek Water District. So I'm not sure what Bill's talking about, but you know, this is the kind of need for dialogue that I'm talking about. We've never had a chance to do what our group has asked for over a year ago. We asked the City Council to do a joint fact-finding process whereby there would be a professional who would sit with the city water department and sit with the citizens and work out these facts. When we're differing on facts, that's so easy to solve, folks. I'm a marriage and family therapist, and if we're talking about an argument over facts, you can find the facts because they're there in the documents. So that's an easy problem to solve, but so far the city hasn't taken us up on that offer, but we still are thinking it would be a good idea. Once again, Bill Coker said, it may well be many years before the city could see any water come our way from this. This is not what John Ricker has to say. His work plan says that the water would come back to Santa Cruz during drought periods, subject to specific conditions on an immediate, limited basis with an increased potential as groundwater levels recover. So again, we got differences of fact. Not hard to resolve this. Soquel Creek Water District is eager to begin this conjunctive use water transfer idea. They've written two letters to the City Council which have not been replied to, and the one they laid out that they would transfer water back to the city. See, there was a whole narrative that was being put out that Soquel Creek Water District would have to wait till their aquifer recovered before they could give any water back to Santa Cruz. Well, Soquel Creek Water District directors, I think, were smart enough to know that this is really a dead idea, if that's the case, that there's got to be something in it for Santa Cruz and something in it for Santa Cruz in the near future. And certainly would be advantageous to Soquel Creek District to get water from Santa Cruz in 6 out of 7 years in the wintertime, and 1 out of those 6 or 7 years give water back to Santa Cruz. It would be a win-win for both districts. They also encouraged Santa Cruz in a letter of April of this year to get going on the water rights revisions that Ricker has proposed. So lastly, conservation pricing as a method that the city could exploit more thoroughly, requiring efficient fixtures in buildings. The pricing right now that you pay if you live in a residence is tiered. There are different tiers of pricing based on how much you use. That's not true of any other category of user other than residential users. So golf courses, for example, use water at the low block 2 rate that is your, in your case, in our case, is listed as indoor water use. So there's really not much of an incentive for dedicated landscape accounts to save water during the summertime, which is when we need it. Now, free installation of toilets is really effective. It's the best bang for the buck, as you can tell if you ask the Soquel Creek Water District. And I want to—I really want council candidates to check this out and to see if you might investigate whether this statement is true. The best insurance for worst-case drought is installing efficient fixtures in all homes. And this is why I say that, because the city has a drought plan in which they know how much they're going to ration each home in the case of a drought. And in the case of a stage 4 drought, which is 35% curtailment, 224 gallons of water per residence per day. Okay. In this case of a stage 5 drought, 50% curtailment, 170 gallons per residence per day. If we look at figures from the American Water Works Association, that first bar, without behavior change, without people taking shorter showers or anything else, if they just have efficient fixtures in their homes, their indoor water use is 174 gallons a day. And so we're there. If there's behavior change involved and you take shorter showers, or maybe you don't wash those towels and sheets quite as often, you got water left over for your garden. In this stage 5 worst case drought, the 1 in 90 year drought that we've experienced, right? So lastly, we would like to invite the city to engage the community in solving the problem. Let's just look at this chart for a second. The residents of Santa Cruz have lowered their water use dramatically in the last 10 years. It's a decline of about 30% in the decade of 2000 to 2010, yeah. And that's our strength, folks. And so we're inviting the city to appeal to our strength, which is pulling together to figure out how we can save water and keep those fish alive at the same time. There's a group called Engineers for Water Alternatives. They're having a forum this October 11th on groundwater recharge, which is a subject that we would like the city to explore. We'd love it if the city sent representatives to that, if city council members would come to that. Another engineers forum is about water market incentives. There's a fellow who's got a plan where people, there'd be kind of a cap and trade where people, you know, there'd be a certain amount of water dedicated to your home. If you use less, you can sell to the people who want to buy more. And that avoids a situation where the water department is in a heavy policing during a drought period. So we're here tonight. The timing is that we are backing Measure P, which is, as you know, would give the citizens the right to vote on desalination. It would put it in the charter so it couldn't be revoked by a future council. It's really more than that. Measure P is more than that. It's about trying to get in dialogue with the city. You know, in the summer of last year, 2011, I co-authored an 18-page set of recommendations with James Bentley, who is a retired water production superintendent for the city, with Sherry Bryan, who's an expert in conservation and ecology action, with Sarah Dameron from the Surfrider Foundation, who's also an expert in conservation. We wrote that report, we gave it to the city, a number of citizens visited each council member, and it merited a one-paragraph response from the water department in a water commission agenda packet. And one more thing, the city council did decide to ask their water department to look into water transfers. But that looking into water transfers with neighboring districts needs some kind of accountability. You know, when you get letters from a neighboring district and you don't reply to those letters, there's no accountability. So they've said they're going to look into it, but we're not sure that their heart was really in it. So Measure P is about this. It's about trying to get attention, trying to say, hey, we would like to be in dialogue, because so far it hasn't happened. And, you know, some people criticize Measure P because, yes, it does cost the city money to put a ballot measure. Every time the city puts a ballot measure on the ballot, the county charges them some money. And some people have said, oh, well, you're charging, you know, you're costing the city ratepayers money. Well, how else would you try to get the city's attention? So tonight I want to ask, first of all, the candidates have an opening statement of 2 minutes each, and then we'll have those other questions from the other groups, and then your questions. Thank you. So we picked the seating arrangements at random here. We didn't want to stick anybody on the end and then thinking that we were trying to stick them there for a reason or something. So this is a random. So you have your 2-minute opening statement. We'll start with Pamela.